Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Marjorie Cohn, professor of law and past president of the National Lawyers Guild, who examines President Trump's Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh's disregard for international law. Jessica Helm, a research fellow at the Silent Spring Institute, who talks about her research into the links between toxic chemicals found in hair products marketed to black women and health disparities found in the U.S. population. And Jackie DeSalvo, an associate professor of English at Baruch College and longtime labor activist, who assesses the state of the U.S. labor movement in 2018. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Global health researchers are optimistic that a new chemical-embedded mosquito net could prevent millions of cases of malaria in sub-Saharan Africa. According to the Guardian newspaper, a two-year clinical study in the Western African nation of Burkina Faso found that a new insecticide-treated net could reduce malaria by 12% compared to conventional bed nets. UK health researcher Steve Lindsay of Durham University declared that this study is important because malaria control in sub-Saharan Africa has stalled due to mosquitoes adapting and becoming resistant to currently used insecticides. The last annual malaria report by the World Health Organization showed malaria infections had increased over the last 2 years. Traditionally, the United States has provided over one-third of anti-malaria funding, but Republicans in the U.S. Congress have slashed the president's malaria initiative by over 40%. The reduced global funding could put an estimated 300,000 people at risk of dying from malaria. Across the rural landscape of upstate New York, for sale signs dot roadways as local farmers are selling their land after enduring years of low food prices with little money left to invest in new equipment. Meanwhile, nearby cities like Utica are mired in poverty. According to In These Times magazine, farm income over the last 5 years has fallen nearly 50%. Dairy farms were the hardest hit, as milk prices have fallen below the price of production for the fifth year in a row. In Wisconsin, over 500 dairy farms have gone out of business in the last year alone, harming local small businesses across the state. In the midst of the crisis, the federal farm bill is advancing on Capitol Hill, which would impose new work requirements on food stamp recipients and slash farm conservation programs. The House version of the farm bill passed with only Republican votes. The Senate-passed version contains fewer cuts to conservation programs and rejects the cuts to food stamps. The bill now sits in conference committee awaiting negotiations to begin after the Labor Day holiday. A toxic red tide of algae has led to massive fish kills off the coast of southern Florida. So far this year, over 260 tons of marine life has washed up on the sandy beaches of Sanibel Island. According to The Guardian, the toxic algae bloom started last November and has impacted beaches along 150 miles of the Florida Gulf Coast. In Sarasota, wildlife scientists recovered 9 dead blue-nosed dolphins in 1 week in August. The smell of rotting fish has disrupted tourism along Gulf Coast beach resorts. The current red algae bloom, which has lasted months longer than is typical, also produces a mild respiratory irritation in some people. Scientists attribute the persistence of the algae this year to a combination of factors, including heavy rainfall, an increase in ocean temperature and salinity, unlucky wind patterns, and pollution. A parallel freshwater algae bloom in Florida is blamed on climate change and pollution from agricultural runoff. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
The Senate confirmation hearings of conservative federal appeals court judge Brett Kavanaugh, President Trump's nominee to replace retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy on the Supreme Court, began with an eruption of protest, both from Democratic senators and citizens in the hearing room urging the nomination be blocked. Democrats are irate that Republicans dumped 42,000 documents about Kavanaugh the night before the first day of hearings, giving them little time to review the record. They are also angry that the Trump administration has withheld some 100,000 documents from the years when Kavanaugh served as President George W. Bush's staff secretary. Kavanaugh's views and rulings have alarmed many who fear that if he's confirmed, he'll cement an extreme right-wing majority in the high court for years to come, eroding civil, worker, voting, consumer, reproductive, and gay rights, as well as undermining access to health care and environmental regulations. Many believe Kavanaugh was nominated by Mr. Trump because the judge believes that a president should be exempt from criminal investigation and prosecution, the very thing that Trump now confronts with the Mueller probe. While Kavanaugh's judicial record and personal views on the issues of abortion and presidential power will be central to questions raised during the Senate hearings, some observers say that Judge Kavanaugh's record of rulings on cases involving international law should also be closely scrutinized. Your reporter spoke with Marjorie Cohn, professor of law and former president of the National Lawyers Guild, who examines Brett Kavanaugh's rulings and record that reveal his disregard for international law.
Well, if Brett Kavanaugh is confirmed, which I am afraid he will be, that will mean that Roberts becomes the swing vote instead of Kennedy, and the entire court will move to the right. I think that we are at risk of losing abortion rights, voting rights, affirmative action, environmental rights, gay rights. He would not put limitations on money in politics. He would be to the right of Kennedy in criminal cases. He will defer to presidential power. All the way around, I think we're going to have a very, very solid right-wing majority on the Supreme Court for decades to come if Kavanaugh is confirmed.
Now, Marjorie, in your recent article, Kavanaugh Scorns International Law and Loves Executive Power, you point out, as a judge, Kavanaugh has actually bolstered executive power when it comes to the status of prisoners at Guantanamo, concerns you have about war-making powers and the like. Can you explain some of your base concerns here about Kavanaugh and his record, his judicial record, when it comes to some of these issues of international law and how the United States abides by treaties that our nation has signed?
The Constitution gives Congress the power to make the law and gives the president the duty to carry them out. And yet Kavanaugh wrote in 2014 that the president must follow the law, quote, at least until the president deems the law unconstitutional, in which event the president can decline to follow the statute until a final court order says otherwise, unquote. That means that Kavanaugh would be signaling to Donald Trump, you are free to disobey laws that Congress passes even if you sign them. Instead of vetoing them, you can sign them, you can attach what's called a signing statement saying, if I think a certain law is unconstitutional, I'm not going to follow it. And that creates a dangerous presumption in favor of a president who refuses to follow the law. Now, Kavanaugh reportedly played a very key role in signing statements during the Bush administration in preparing these signing statements where Bush reserved the right to ignore parts of congressional statutes that he didn't agree with. And when Kavanaugh was on the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit in nearly all the so-called war on terror cases that came before him, he deferred to Bush. He voted to uphold Bush's decision, and I have no doubt he would do the same with Trump.
Marjorie, I did want to ask you about Brett Kavanaugh and what we know about his role in the White House when he worked there from 2003 to 2006 under George W. Bush, as it relates to directives from the White House during that time to encourage torture of prisoners that were captured in the Bush invasion of Afghanistan and the capture of other prisoners linked to 9/11. I should note here that the Trump administration has refused to release some 100,000 documents for a time covering
the period when Brett Kavanaugh worked at the White House as staff secretary.
That's right. Well, after it was revealed that detainees were being tortured, not just at Guantanamo, but also in the CIA black sites, we don't know how many, probably thousands of them, and when the photographs from Abu Ghraib, those horrific photographs, were released, John McCain, who was tortured in Vietnam, had pushed for an amendment to the 2005 Detainee Treatment Act, basically reaffirming the prohibition against cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. And Bush signed that law. He didn't veto the Detainee Treatment Act, but he signed it and issued a signing statement saying, well, I'm not going to follow that McCain amendment if I don't want to, if I think it's unconstitutional. Senator Patrick Leahy was questioning Kavanaugh at his confirmation hearing in 2006 before the Senate Judiciary Committee, confirmation hearing for a spot on the U.S. Court of Appeals. Leahy asked Kavanaugh about that signing statement to the so-called McCain amendment, and Kavanaugh said, quote, I did see that signing statement, Senator, unquote. And when Leahy pushed Kavanaugh about how he felt about that signing statement, Kavanaugh gave a non-responsive answer saying, oh, the United States doesn't torture. Totally non-responsive, begging the question. This is unprecedented that the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee and ultimately the Senate, who will make the final decision, does not have access to all the records for a nominee to the Supreme Court, and it's clearly a cover-up. There's no doubt about it. They want to rush him through, put him on the court before the November midterm elections.
That was Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law and former president of the National Lawyers Guild. Her book, Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues, is just out in a new edition. Find a link to Cohn's recent article titled Kavanaugh Scorns International Law and Loves Executive Power by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. For the first time, research has been performed on endocrine-disrupting chemicals found in hair products primarily marketed to African-American women, who tend to buy more hair care products than women of other ethnicities. The study by the Silent Spring Institute was published earlier this year in the journal Environmental Research. The groundwork for the study was laid by Tamara James Todd, an African-American researcher from Harvard University. The Environmental Working Group also released a report analyzing the products based on ingredients listed on the labels. Endocrine-disrupting chemicals are substances that interfere with the body's hormones. The findings could help researchers understand why black women have higher exposures to hazardous chemicals than other groups, and how these elevated exposures contribute to health disparities in the U.S. population overall. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Jessica Helm, the lead author of the study and postdoctoral research fellow at Silent Spring, about the specific chemicals identified, their health impacts, and changes in the marketing of these products that might result from the spotlight shown on the hazards revealed.
So we looked at 18 hair products, and we looked at several different categories of use. As you mentioned, hair relaxers was one. Hair relaxers are used to straighten hair, generally speaking. And we tested three of those, including two that were specifically marketed to children. We were particularly interested in that since children can be developmentally susceptible to the effect of endocrine-disrupting chemicals. We also looked at hair lotions or moisturizers, and those are used to moisturize hair, as well as a leave-in conditioner, several anti-frizz products, and a hot air hair oil, which is also used basically to moisturize hair. They had a lot of things in common in the sense that, for example, they all contained fragrance chemicals. Many of them contained UV filters. Most of them contained parabens and diazole phthalate. Parabens are products that are used to prevent microbial growth, and so those are kind of commonly used in personal care products in general, and we found those in most of the products we tested. And diazole phthalate is a phthalate that is used as a solvent for fragrances, so we also very commonly found those in these products, which is not surprising considering they all contained fragrances. There were some differences in the sense that the antifrizz, for example, contained very high concentrations of these chemicals called cycloxyloxanes, and those are used to give hair a kind of a silky feel, which potentially makes sense for an antifrizz product. And then the hair relaxers actually contained the highest levels of some of these prohibited or regulated chemicals that we looked at. So we checked the list of endocrine disrupting chemicals that we tested for against some regulations in the EU, and regulations have prohibited the use of chemicals in cosmetics in the EU and the European Union. And the highest levels of five of those were actually found in these hair relaxers, and specifically in the hair relaxers that were marketed to children, which was of concern.
Jessica Helm, why did you decide to focus on these products in particular?
There are a couple of reasons that we focused on these products. One is that we know that Black women suffer disproportionately from a number of hormone-related health problems, and there's a possibility that these health problems may be affected by endocrine-disrupting chemicals, environmental exposures to endocrine-disrupting chemicals. For example, they have higher rates of certain uterine fibroids, earlier onset of puberty, higher rates of infertility, and actually rising rates of endometrial and breast cancers. So we knew that they have these higher rates of certain hormone-related health problems. And then other studies have found that they also, Black women have higher levels of certain chemicals that we know are used in consumer products and specifically in personal care products. And those are the chemicals that I mentioned, parabens and diethyl phthalate. But we know that Black women have higher levels of those, so we wondered whether, again, knowing that women, Black women use different hair products and more of certain kinds of hair products, whether these products that are more or less unique to Black women could potentially be a source of exposure to some of the chemicals that we have been identified as being higher in Black women, and whether there might be other chemicals present that could potentially be contributing to, you know, hormone disruption or endocrine disruption. You know, 84% of the chemicals that we detected weren't listed on the product label. The FDA is the agency that regulates this, and manufacturers are required to list all intentionally added ingredients on the product label. There are some exceptions, and I suspect that most of the chemicals that we found may have fallen into some of these exceptions. For example, fragrance chemicals do not have to be explicitly labeled. They can just use the word fragrance. We do recommend, based on our previous research, that they look for plant-based products and products without fragrances, because based on our research, those will tend to have fewer of the types of chemicals that we've identified here. That's one challenge, I think, for consumers and also for manufacturers to be aware that their products contain other chemicals other than what they've listed on the label, and to try to identify and prevent those occurrences.
With this somewhat greater awareness of the toxic ingredients in these products, do you know if either some companies have started removing some of these ingredients and or if Black women are buying them less?
Well, I think that there is an evolution going on in general in the market towards more natural hair. And what that means for Black women in terms of hairstyles is less chemical straightening and more moisturizing products. So that's sort of a shift in the types of products that are being used, for one thing. And there's an appearance of more, quote-unquote, natural products. So these are products that are made with plant-based ingredients. Some of them say paraben-free or phthalate-free on them. And I think that that has been driven by some interest in just having a more natural hair and using more natural products.
That was Jessica Helm, postdoctoral research fellow at the Silent Spring Institute in Newton, Massachusetts. Learn more about the danger of toxic substances found in hair products marketed to Black women and links between environmental chemicals and women's health by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On Labor Day, the nation pauses to remember and celebrate the hard-fought victories of the U.S. labor movement over the decades, which include establishment of the 8-hour workday, overtime pay, weekends off, minimum wage laws, paid vacation and paid sick days, workplace safety standards, health benefits, retirement security, and unemployment insurance. But in 2018, labor unions are under severe attack by corporations, the Republican Party, and allied right-wing political organizations, such as the billionaire Koch brothers-funded Americans for Prosperity. 27 states across the U.S. already had so-called right-to-work laws, which prevents public sector unions from collecting fair share fees from non-union members who benefit from labor management negotiated contracts. But on June 27th, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against labor in the Janus versus AFSCME case by a 5-4 vote, overturning a 40-year-old high court precedent, extending this prohibition to all 50 states. However, against this bleak backdrop, a wave of militant teacher strikes were launched across the nation this year in conservative states, including West Virginia, Oklahoma, and Arizona, along with major teacher protests in North Carolina, Kentucky, and Colorado. To many labor supporters, this demonstrates that the U.S. labor movement is capable of a rebound, despite a steep decline in union membership from more than 20% of the workforce in 1983 to only 10.7% in 2017. Your reporter spoke with Jackie DeSalvo, an associate professor of English at Baruch College and delegate to the Professional Staff Congress Union at the City University of New York. Here DeSalvo assesses the state of the U.S. labor movement in 2018.
Well, the labor movement is really in a very weak and disastrous state right now. I mean, one figure that gives you a sense of it, that in 1954, 34% of the workforce was unionized. Now it's 10.7%. And that is mostly public sector, which is why teachers are so important, because the private sector has been devastated by globalization, basically just shifting manufacturing abroad, and immigration, to the extent that immigrants are threatened to the point where they're afraid to join unions or engage in struggles. So we're under all kinds of attacks. Right now, Trump just arbitrarily cutting the raises won by public employees. And, of course, the most dramatic thing that we saw was years ago, not that long ago, when Scott Walker in Wisconsin canceled collective bargaining, and as a result, the teachers took over the state capitol. I went out there because I happened to have been in Wisconsin when the first graduate assistance union was organized, and it was the graduate assistants that took over the capitol and then sent out a call, and the teachers and eventually workers of all kinds occupied the capitol demanding collective bargaining rights. So there have been a number of fightbacks. We've heard about all kinds of levels of inequality of wealth and income that are occurring, but one of the ones relevant to workers is that in 1965, the relative of CEO to workers' income was 20 to 1. Now it's 295 to 1. So inequality of workers vis-a-vis management have increased dramatically.
Jackie, what was interesting in the 2016 election was that you had a number of union households voting for Donald Trump. People talked about labor union members' frustration with stagnating wages and Donald Trump's populist rhetoric, as well as his focus on scapegoating immigrants for people's economic issues here in this country, did persuade a lot of union families to vote for Donald Trump. Tell us a little bit about what you think the psychology is then in 2016 and what, if anything, has changed in 2018.
Trump, although he's very ignorant about many things, he is pretty smart politically, and he was pretty smart to put his focus on jobs in two ways. One was he was going to fight the trade pacts, and the other was he was going to fight immigrants. And workers heard jobs, jobs, jobs. And they knew that Hillary Clinton and the neoliberals were doing nothing for them in terms of their economic income or their employment. And they're also one of the reasons people vote for Trump is if they want to vote against the neoliberals, there's no progressive force to vote for. There's no third party. There's no strong labor left. The labor movement hasn't created any kind of an independent movement, independent of the neoliberals. So workers really had no place to go. Now, I'm not saying there was nothing negative. there was a lot of racism and anti-immigrant feeling among the sector of workers, not all workers for sure, but I think a big part of it, we have to recognize it, and unless labor begins a fight back that includes an independent political movement, that's what's going to happen. One of the interesting things about the strikes in places like West Virginia is that they refused to tail the politicians. The union itself was going and negotiating with the politicians, which offered them a paltry increase. And the workers said, no, we'll stay on strike. We're not going to follow the politicians. And they did, and they won.
Well, just a final question, Jackie. When you look at the leadership of the AFL-CIO, Richard Trumka and other leaders of major unions in the country, do you note any changes, any new thinking, maybe lessons learned from these recent militant teacher strikes they've seen born across the country? The mindset of labor certainly has to change if there's going to be a turnaround in the loss of membership that's gone on and on, the hemorrhaging of membership year after year.
There are beginning to be class-conscious movements, such as the Poor People's Campaign. The Poor People's Campaign, it's trying to unite environmentalism, anti-racism, anti-militarism, and economic justice. And by doing it, linking up people across races, across geographic areas. And I think that the labor movement should be doing that. That's what it should be doing. It should be forming militant, politically independent coalitions that support unions and workers and the minimum wage and Medicare for all and free tuition for colleges. I mean, we need a movement with a progressive program. And where's the labor movement? It hasn't been doing that because it's so servile to the Democratic Party. And it will support any Democrat, no matter how neoliberal.
That was Jackie DeSalvo, an associate professor of English at Baruch College and delegate to the Professional Staff Congress Faculty Union at the City University of New York. Find more analysis and commentary on the state of the U.S. labor movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, KHOI in Ames, Iowa, KAOS in Olympia, Washington, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.